So, okay, in this special issue, as Encarnacion gave you briefly the content of it, emerged, its title, first of all, is Feminism in Times of Austerity, Racism and Anti-Feminism, which is very relevant to the topics of this very interesting and timely actual lecture series, which I'm very happy to be part of. And this special issue came out actually of an international and very rich conference which took place at the University of Gießen, Justus Liebig University in Gießen. And the conference title was Feminism's Reloaded, Contested Terrains in Times of Anti-Feminism, Racism and Austerity. So what we did, we took the very conventional way of editing a special issue. So we put together five very comprehensive articles together that are uniquely focusing on the social complexity and political emergency in which feminist politics in Europe is debated in the midst of austerity politics. Of course, these articles, who wrote those articles, people are not economics, so you won't find any economic terms in those articles. However, each article actually looks at how anti-genderism and xenophobia are linked to the rise of right wings and how particularly extreme right wing hinge upon the discourse and narratives about economic crisis in the effort of creating a fertile ground to stabilize their political actions and beliefs. So that is to say, main concern of the article is I will set it so you can have the entire picture. So let's say the main concern of the article is collectively reflect on the potential for feminist interventions in debates on austerity politics while analyzing its links to anti-genderism and racism. And while editing these highly enlightening articles, what remained for us as editors important was to engage in these discussions, that is how anti-genderism and racism get coupled in the discourse of financial crisis without becoming invested in a feminist we. And in order to not to produce that sense, that is what we actually critically distance ourselves from, that is patriotic nationalist rhetoric. As the presentation held at the conference and the articles published in this special issue show us, patriotic nationalist rhetoric becomes one of the most essential rubric to narrate the financial crisis. This is what we all hear about here and there, you know, that the financial crisis is can be saved in a national border, leaving the Europe, turning back to your own currency, and so on and so forth. This is how it produces itself. And we were even metaphorically trying to distance ourselves, which would create any sense of national unity in that respect. Therefore, this special issue is exploratively designed to ground the voices of anti-racist progressive politics that is committed to transformative and distributive justice without getting trapped in creating a unified gendered and sexualized identity. So, worrying about feminist future is thus legitimated. We said, yeah, we should worry, but in the condition of that, we should take it as a sense of urgency, which we call for common reflections and political alliances in the hope that the cases brought out through this issue delineate a way of talking, writing, and discussing new paths of thinking about feminist politics, especially in the times of anti-genderism, racism and austerity. And I will give a small content about the articles. The volume starts with Anna Kazatriza's intriguing contribution entitled Nesting Crisis, as you see here. And in this article, Considering the impact of the financial crisis of 2008 on Greece, Kazatrezes discusses the explosion of crisis discourses as a medium for ideological negotiation of nation-state borders. And also she analyzes the implementation of securitization measures of border controls, for instance. Suggesting that crises need to be examined as a semantic of intervention in sovereign democratic states, she draws on the refugee crisis and the debt crisis in the reshaping of the nation state. She looks at how those two different so-called crises is actually coming together or exclude each other in what kind of like framework and discourses. She claims that within this framework, the rationalized nations other is constructed and reaffirmed as a threat for social cohesion, while the financial crisis becomes a nationally managed issue. So in this article, she shows us how the emergence of certain articulations such as financial crisis, Greece financial crisis as the national issue, right? It's our crisis. It is crisis of Greece, which belongs to the border of Greece. We experience it. We live it. That's why it's a national issue. But at the same time, seeing, for instance, refugee crisis as an international issue, right? It is important to us. It's imposed to us, and so on and so forth. And that's by giving the differentiated victim positions to each parties, the refugees were not seen as the affected part of the austerity politics, since the financial crisis was seen as not their crisis. So actually, Anna is looking here, in writes in her words, in Greece, financial crisis effectively and politically becomes ours rather than theirs, and indeed constitutes the we and the they. So this is how we see those kind of we and they discourse again reproduce itself even in the framework of financial crisis. And another effective political turn in the language of patriotism, as Maya Sager and Diana Molinari show in their article, Safety for Whom? Exploring Femonationalism and Care Racism in Sweden, occurs in the context of care and care work. In their contribution, the authors explore the reactualization of racist imaginaries in current national debates on security measures, also encapsulates the appropriation of feminist issues by right-wing xenophobic parties and neo-Nazi-inspired organizations in order to mobilize racist and anti-immigration arguments. The authors also focus on the discourse on safety, nationalist, which indicates the co-optation of the care discourse by a nationalist and racist agenda. However, as they demonstrate, this discourse is countered by self-identified anti-racist feminists, many of them with migrant backgrounds, struggling for alternative understanding of safety that transcend heteropatriarchal and ethno-nationalist agendas. So another example of that, the appropriation of this feminist rhetoric, how those that feminists have been talking about, for instance, care work and so on and so forth, how it is getting appropriated in extreme right-wing discourse, was shown by Suvi Keskinen's contribution, which is entitled The Crisis of White Hegemony, Neo-Nationalist Feminities, and Anti-Racist Feminism. And in this article, Keskinen explores the rise of neo-nationalist politics and racist activism in Finland that is rising in recent years. And attention is particularly placed on a growing public focus on gendered and sexualized intimacies, including gendered violence and harassment negotiated in racial terms. In this article, Keskinen brilliantly demonstrates the process of how a progressive but also racist anti-migration women's activism has developed itself within the context of fighting against sexual violence and harassment. So she claims that in particular, white nationalist movements operate by evocating white border guard femininities. This is important that she was particularly focusing on how those femininities actually reproducing itself on the discourse of protecting the borders. And in her words, Keskin explains this framework: in an already crisis-ridden country where austerity politics and severe public cuts framed the future perspectives of the citizens, a crisis atmosphere was easily triggered. That is, the crisis of hegemonic whiteness was to large extent verbalized in relation to sexual otherness, but not solely. The second source of crisis was related to the inevitability to control the territorial borders of nation. And shifting the geographical focus from Scandinavia to Eastern Europe, Veronika Grzebalska and Andrea Petru propose another kind of framework in their article, The Gender Modus Operandi of the Illiberal Transformation in Hungary and Poland. They are comparing what's going on in Hungary and Poland in terms of this anti-gender movement. They are particularly focusing on this, and also looking and trying to actually understand the rise of the new hybrid political system, which they described as the illiberal state. Based on this comparative analysis of the ideological and policy tools of illiberal ruling parties in Hungary and Poland, the authors argue that the 21st century Central European illiberal transformation is a process deeply reliant on gender politics, and that a feminist analysis is central to understanding the current regime change, both in terms of their ideological underpinnings and with respect to their modus operandi. And they also show how, for instance, family mainstreaming and anti-gender politics have been one of the main pillars on which the illiberal state has been erected, and through which security, equality, and human rights have been redefined. So, as being the last article of this special issue, Umut Erol's contribution entitled Saving and Reproducing the Nation, Nation's Struggles Around the Politics of Social Production, Gender, Migration and Race in Austerity UK, raises the question of how the organization and politics around the family are embedded in the social reproduction of the nation in gender and racial terms. Taking the case of the UK and proposing a theoretical focus on reproduction, Erol provides an eye-opening contextualization of this focus within a wider European frame by concentrating on the debates across the far right and mainstream right wing. So, embedded in a racial vocabulary, as she discusses, migrant families are quite often set outside the boundaries of care, exemplified through the policy of no recourse to public funding. This was a special program which was established by the UK government in that time. And as she states, particularly this program, this policy, show that how immigration and welfare policy can be used to construct other outsiders to the nation without the right to be cared for within the nation, nor the rights to care for their children in dignity. So this is the more or less what we were doing in this special issue. And so, but at the same time, so what's going on in Germany? After hearing all this very brief analytic perspective, like about Finland and Sweden and so on and so forth, and the UK. So what is going on in Germany? When we look at the impact and effect, how the impact and effect of the financial crisis constructed in Germany, we see a very different kind of narrative, right? Which is different from other narratives that we hear from the UK, for instance, from Finland and so on and so forth. Or particularly from those European countries, the financial crisis hit severely. And in these narratives, I just collected some of the titles for you. In these narratives, Germany portrayed as the winner, actually, of the financial crisis, as it is claimed that it benefited from financial crisis and proved its economic strength and stability. So there is a different narrative that Germany's economical strength is actually admired in those narratives and so on and so forth. This is how the titles are reading. And as we know already in 2008, the German government actually announced the largest package of cuts since World War II. So as I said at the beginning, I'm not an economist, therefore I won't be able to provide you a comprehensive analysis of Germany's position during the recession and so on and so forth. But what I know generally, when we talk about cuts, budget cuts, actually we mean that the austerity measures which are taken by the governments in order to underinvest in countries' social and physical infrastructure. And yet again, another generic explanation on how governments usually legitimate those kind of cuts because they say that the incomes are decreasing, people lose their jobs, so they spend less. Since they spend less, the state receives low taxes, and therefore it reduces its investment in public and social services. So this is the very general argument. And especially health and education becomes the public sectors that those cuts are usually heavily concentrated on. And I think this point is particularly important to bear in mind in order to make the long-term social and political deprivation recognizable that are caused by the austerity politics, which we are also more interested in. So to put short, the German economic structure were praised due to its historical low unemployment rate and increasing domestic growth. So some also called this as German miracle. Yeah, this was a German miracle. How did they do it? Although other countries were struggling with those economic rises and so on and so forth. So but some report says otherwise. However, for instance, as this report indicates, that one of the miracles, actually, as a social scientist, when I look at those, you know, the constellation, what I see as a miracle is that the fact that, as it's stated in this report, that austerity politics actually created a new phenomenon in Germany, which is called working poor. So it sounds kind of oxymoron, but it is not, because during the recession in Germany, the precarious jobs doubled and people tended to take more time, even mini jobs, and they still lived in poverty while having sometimes multiple jobs. So they are employed, but they still have lower income. And still, some of the reports are stating still 10% of the population own 60% of the assets, while 50% have practically no assets at all. Above all this, the gender gap in wages remained more or less the same throughout the decade and stayed at 20%. And in Germany in 2012, the unemployment rate of the women of color was 10%, while it was for men of color 13%. And Denise already mentioned Encarnacion's incredible article. When I read it, I was also I loved it, how she actually described the entire this complexity of migration and coloniality and how it actually like imported into and throughout the racial capitalism. I also came across this quote which explains actually why this miracle is not a miracle, or whose miracle, who belongs to this miracle, because she said, in the current Muslim migration nexus, the refugee has been reduced to a potential worker. Asylum policies seem to be turning into a new way of regulating and controlling racialized labor migration. One of the measures that were agreed in the German parliament across all party lines was introduction of €1 jobs for refugees in June 2016. The measures was intended to initially create jobs for the 100,000 people who had arrived in Germany as refugees. So very last graphic again that you see actually in this table, the unemployment rate of the immigrants in Germany is three times higher than of German natives. So then, of course, you started to ask, like, whose miracle is this, right? Who sees a miracle into this? And because, of course, maybe one more time, it's important to emphasis that, underline that, the fact that those kind of unemployment rates are created, the low unemployment rate is created on the cost of sharp cuts in unemployment benefits, making labor more flexible by weakening the trade unions, for instance, applying heavy bureaucratic pressure on the jobless, reducing social security, extending working hours. This is also very important because although they called it mini jobs, part-time jobs, the working hours were extended. So to put it short, the miracle was not happening on the side of the poor, on the side of the people of color, women, and the immigrants. So apparently, yes, someone was winning, but not those groups. So why are they usually in those kind of discourses came across to be the guilty part of this economic crisis, why people are talking about them? I want also go into a little bit like we all know that historically it's also proven that the extreme right wing benefit the most from the austerity politics. I mean, when there is an austerity politics, they actually exercise their and reproduce their always already racist and sexist rhetoric. So they try to find this tentative ground in order to build themselves up again. And of course, this is not a coincidence that we witness. The rise of the extreme right wing in Germany, attacks on refugees' houses, and, for instance, online trolling practices against gender studies, and so on and so forth. But this is also not to say that this extreme right wing finds immediately this is an economic crisis. I don't see them different parties. Like, they are very much entangled with those who actually responsible for those economic crises. And already in 1981, I'm going to give this one to you. This is not relevant, but I couldn't go back. Because I just want to show you, not because I didn't find any other sources of written contemporarily, but I just want to show the banality of this discourse. This is not to say that we should not take them in important case, but for instance, in 1981, June Kress stated that despite its visibility in 1981, when I read this passage, I was thinking like it was written today, because she says despite its visibility and prominence, the right-wing attack on women's rights is by no means an isolated phenomenon. Although it would appear that the strongest organizational forces behind the current rightward mobilization against women are the anti-abortion single interest groups that seek to destroy women's reproductive right and to preserve the nuclear family, in reality, these organizations are but a small part of a massive network linked by a common leadership, financial backing, and ideological focus. So we can also argue that this ideological focus, now I'm coming to more concrete example, universities as an institution, that creating highly precarious working conditions, for instance, at universities, non-transparently operating monopolization of third-party funding, which makes us as social scientists also very difficult to focus on the topics that we are concerned the most. I would also like to highlight that the austerity politics do not only impact the assets and market flow, but also the production and the dissemination of knowledge. In this respect, especially in times of crisis, the scholars, researchers, and intellectuals who are invested in the question of social justice and social transformation in favor of marginalized groups and individuals become more subject to institutional and governmental ignorance, political stigmatization, and discrediting that hinder the process of producing and distributing of particular knowledge by imposing upon us what I call knowledge austerity. Since, particularly in times of crisis, the privileged group of the societies tend to hush the critics, intellectuals, artists, and researchers, and suppresses the rages coming from the marginalized groups for the sake of the nation's stability. So the effect of crisis on the knowledge production also turns into a disciplining act, and sometimes reaches an aggressive level by defaming the scholars, disciplines, and researchers by arguing that we need to focus on our real concerns, forgetting or perhaps rather ignoring the fact that actually those concerns to great extent have racial and gender parameters, since pre-existing vulnerabilities get magnified, actually, during the crisis. Should I stop here, or would you like to go?
It's already been 20 minutes, maybe you could. Somewhere.
Yeah, okay. Because I want to, from here, I want to come to another aspects of how we deal those kind of like imposed knowledge austerity, for instance, that somebody tells us of what kind of science is science, if we are producing science, if we are producing knowledge practices, and so on and so forth.
Should I continue and then you can come back?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah, of course we can do that.
So. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. And so what I would like to hear also, because I think this is also what made you put this lecture series together. This is some sort of like very hilarious, again, this argumentation that gender studies is not science, if it is science, and so on and so forth, which actually stealing a lot of time from us because we actually want to focus on other issues that is immediately and urgently has to be addressed. So what I want to suggest here, and perhaps also give the word to Encarnacion, here, drawing on the defaming practices, you know, that get hyped, especially in this condition at the universities and institutions, I would suggest that respectability, right? Respectability becomes a new effective currency in this crisis that we are facing today, particularly how we deal with this knowledge austerity. So respectability, what is respectability? As I said before, it is about like who can be respected, if the knowledge I am producing is can be respected and it has accountability and so on. So someone else is actually like trying to define which knowledge is deserved to be respected and who should get ignored and degraded. It was also remarkable how this effective currency entered even to the workplaces once again. Actually, now it is again some sort of like very old writings because I love this because it also shows that how much we are still dealing with the past today, when we are talking about what is the feminist future and so on, these kind of debates are coming and coming back again. So this quote taken from Catherine... Yes, now I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. Article shows how this ideological focus has been operating at the academic context from the very beginning of establishing gender studies at the universities, because particularly those ideological focus think of women's studies, she wrote, as the wedge of a force that will threaten the person's security and their intellectual principles. Cornered, anxious, angry, they fight as if they were fighting for survival, which they were very well might be, either to ensure or to shrive, to be innovative, they use conventional weapons of academic warfare. Hostile wit, such as a visit to Professor X to warn him about Mrs. Y, appeals to academic standards and relies on the protection of a powerful, prestigious patron. And these weapons still work, she writes. And still, and I want to, perhaps Encarna has more to say about if those weapons still operate in 2019 at workplaces. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.